Jesse, Dr. Jesse, my apologies.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Of course. We were just talking off air, but yeah, I got to give you your flowers for being a doctor. You know, being a PhD or pursuing your PhD is just a long road. From somebody who's been in academia, I got my master's, and the thought of getting a PhD for me wasn't something that got me excited at all, but I really do appreciate the people who do. And it's just, it's something that people appreciate how much effort goes into that. So it's a pleasure to have you, Dr. Jesse, on the show today. Do you go by doctor, or do you kind of drop the doctor?
Nah, I drop it. I'm a professor at a university. And so the only place where I kind of have that title is with my students. And even at that point, I'm just like, call me Professor Hoffman, I don't even care sometimes if you call me Jesse, but some other people do, like older professors and stuff, you know, like sometimes we'll get up in arms about that. But, you know, Jesse is what I go by.
For sure. I love it. Well, I'll call you Jesse, but yeah, I've had, I think, one or two doctors on the podcast before. Some people are pretty particular. Usually the people who aren't are usually the people that I get along with better anyway. So thank you for that.
I always say, like, you know, when I'm as a dietitian and having a doctorate, like a PhD, being in kind of the clinical field somewhat, and then having a title where you have doctor is confusing for people. Because I don't think a lot of people really understand what a PhD is in the most part. And so you have to clarify a lot. I'm not that kind of doctor. Don't call me doctor. Like when I'm working with clients and stuff, like, you know, don't call me doctor. That feels icky.
Totally. Yeah. And yeah, the differentiation between like people going to school or you're taking a class versus, yeah, you're going to a clinic. Confusion is there for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, obviously the route to get a, you know, MD, or a DO or some of these other doctor credentials is different than getting a PhD. They are two very different, but I think they all warrant their respect because it is, you know, not a lifelong pursuit, but it's a time commitment for,
it's a commitment for sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
Nice. You know, I've wanted to do a gut health episode for a long time.
Yeah.
I have had a lot of guests on the show and I've enjoyed talking about a lot of different things, but gut health was one of the episodes where I would not do it justice if I went through and talked about a handful of things today. We could do surface level stuff, great. But having someone like yourself is so important, especially for a lot of these topics in terms of debunking misinformation or talking about what we do and don't know and talking about the science behind some of these things. So long story short, I was very particular with who I wanted to have as a guest on the show to talk about gut health. Because it is a sensitive, it's a very trending topic. And you could find a million gut health experts out there, but not many have PhD or RD or have a ton of experience kind of behind their name as well. So I'm really happy that we got to carve out some time today and talk about some of these things. Before we dive into this laundry list of topics here, we're laughing off air. I'm like, this could be a 5-hour conversation. We'll do our best and I'll try and keep us on track with certain things. But before we dive in, do your podcast intro. Tell us about your pursuit in academia and getting your PhD, becoming a dietitian, any personal experience that relates to that. Just tell the people who have never heard of you, myself too, because I don't know much about your backstory either, but tell us how you got into this space and kind of how you arrived here today.
Yeah. So I have a very roundabout way into getting into the field of nutrition and then becoming a dietitian. If being in a professor in the field of nutrition and dietetics, as a lot of our students will relate to, I have a history of an eating disorder. And so that's, you know, a lot of people have family history with medical issues or personal story. So everyone gets into nutrition for a specific reason. And usually there's some sort of personal or family history there. But that's really what got me interested in nutrition for the wrong reason. So I always kind of caveat with that. But I went into undergrad because that was kind of towards the end of my high school that, you know, I struggled with some, you know, eating disorder behaviors and stuff. But I went into undergrad as a biology major, thinking I was going to be a vet. So I was going into, you know, thinking I was going to go to vet school. Very quickly decided I like animals a little too much to do that. So kind of went back to biology, switched to biology education, because I was like, I come from a line of teachers. I like teaching. did a rotation in high school, absolutely not. You know, went straight back to biology as my major there. And then towards the end of there, my undergrad, I was like, I really am interested in nutrition. I am at a healthy place now. I've seen the value of nutrition and dietetics and working with a dietitian and fueling your body. And so I pursued a master's in nutrition. And that's where I really started kind of going backwards and, you know, taking the courses to become a registered dietitian. Because if anyone listening that unfamiliar, like to become a registered dietitian, you have to have these host of undergraduate courses. You have to now have a master's, and now you have to do, you know, a dietetic internship too. So the master's is a new bit in there recently, but it's a very lengthy process. So kind of backslid into that, finished some of those during my master's, was doing research during my master's and really loved it. Decided then, I was like, I think I'm not done. I think I want to go get a PhD. So kind of didn't know what I was getting myself into during my master's with research and stuff, but and had no formal plan of like, this is what I want to get a PhD for sure. I want to be a professor. It kind of just the stars aligned. And I was just saying yes to opportunities as they presented themselves. During my PhD, I really realized I didn't want to be a big researcher in terms of work at a mega research institution, write grants. You know, I really enjoyed teaching. And then I came across a teaching focused postdoc. So I ended up doing a postdoc that was teaching focused. And it was actually in the space of online curriculum development, which was in 2019 before the pandemic. So it was very timely. So my story is very much like serendipity and like stars aligning and just kind of trusting that I'm going to get to where I'm meant to be. And I'm still open to, you know, expanding and growing. So yeah.
Very interesting path. I share a similar caveat to there, where both my parents were teachers as well. I thought I was going to be a teacher also. They were special ed teachers. I did some coursework in undergrad, and I was like, yeah, like maybe in a school setting, not my thing, but look at you today. You're definitely a professor, a teacher, probably the highest form of being a teacher. I feel like all dietitians are teachers at some level, depending on what setting you're working in, some more than others. So yeah, teaching is something that you will always do, that I'll likely always do. And it's just, you don't have to be in a classroom setting necessarily to do that. But
yep.
The beautiful part about science and all this stuff is we have to be health communicators at the end of the day as well. Tell me about what you did your dissertation on. Just, did you pick your program based on professors or location that offered a certain area of interest that you were excited about? Or was it kind of like, hey, I can get into this place and I'm interested, so let's go for it? Like, how did that come to be, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah. So it was a little bit of strategy there. It was not based on like what I was interested in studying. It was truly based on, I met my husband during my master's program when we got married at the end of our master's. He's nutrition too. And he was going for a PhD as well. So we were playing the game of like, let's try to find something that's middle ground, meets both of our needs. And so we ended up settling. University of Kentucky had some great opportunities for both of us to be fully funded, you know, not have to bust ourselves to write a ton of grants. We were going to go into, you know, labs that were established or, you know, had a good footing. And it felt with mentors that were very supportive of what we wanted to. And so I ended up joining a lab with a very senior mentor who was pretty much, you know, starting his phase out. You know, I was one of his last PhD students, but very well-funded program or lab. And I come in and he basically is like, whatever you really want to do, as long as it falls under what we're funded for, which were, I was the only nutrition student in a lab of toxicologists, really. And he was a PhD RD as well. So he valued nutrition. But they were studying environmental pollutants and the way they impact health, cardiometabolic health. And no one in the field was really studying the gut. And I had toyed with the gut microbiome in the gut during my master's program, because my mentor there was interested in it. And this is like 2013 to 2015, when the gut microbiome is super new, even in the field of research. It's like hot, hot area field of research. It hadn't even hit like the mainstream public yet. And so we started doing a little research there, and that's where I fell in love with it. And so when given the freedom to kind of decide my own project during my PhD, I was like, gut microbiome 100%, because the pollutants that we were studying were called polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. They're not utilize today in terms of we're not manufacturing them to utilize them. They get manufactured in some bioprocessing of paint products and certain things, but they're found a lot in the environment. We still find them in like transformers, old transformers and stuff like that. But they're a class of persistent organic pollutants. And the persistent word is the most important there in terms of they do not degrade easily in the environment. So once they're here to stay, and they bioaccumulate along the food chain. So things eat them and then we end up eating them. And so no one was looking at the gut and the gut microbiome at the time. And so I was like, this feels like a really good opportunity. There was like, you know, maybe one or two papers that was starting to toy with the idea. And I was like, let's go for it. And so there was no one at the University of Kentucky doing gut microbiome research, really, except for me. And ironically, my husband got into it as well. But he was in the field of Alzheimer's research. And so we were the two kind of, the trailblazer sounds vain, but, you know, trying to figure out the gut microbiome stuff at a institution that didn't have resources to do gut microbiome stuff. So, but it worked out. It was fun.
Yeah. Very interesting routes. I can already, see a listener listen to this right now and already getting the shit scared out of them, but just by like hearing PFAS and forever chemicals, and because people are not on social media as, as recent too, people are obsessed with microplastics and environmental pollutants and how it's having an impact. You got to buy special underwear or buy these special pans and everything. And the truth to that, we're not saying it's, there's no relation to it at all. But again, we're going to talk today about kind of the hierarchy of importance and what things are ideally are probably going to take care of our health a little bit more than others. Yeah. And there's always room for discussion nuances with this, but as it relates to the microbiome is a very interesting kind of process as well. And
the nutrition side of that was I did a proof of concept showing that yes, these disrupt the microbiome. And to caveat, this is all in rodent models because you can't give humans pollutants and then study them. It's not ethical. But we then did a follow-up study and looked at can certain fibers bind to these pollutants because they do enter what we call enterohepatic circulation, where they're kind of circulating with bile and cholesterol and stuff like that too. Can we capture those like within the intestine and have us excrete them? And it did seem like, at least within mice, there was a level of benefit with that, of higher fiber can help bind that. And so that's a good, if people are getting scared right now, like maybe go grab some fruits and vegetables and make sure we're eating those.
Totally. Totally. Well, kind of before we start talking about food and interventions and stuff, I kind of want to take a step back a little bit before we keep taking steps forward and kind of set the scene and talk about what the gut is. That is a buzzword in its own. I think these days, I think people hear the word gut and they have an appreciation for it. It's like, oh yeah, inside my body or my, colon or, my microbiome, like whatever it is. I almost think that's too simple. And it's something that if we don't appreciate all the systems that kind of equate to what our quote unquote gut is, I think there's missed opportunities for education and appreciation for how many inputs are going in here. And at the end of the day, people just like, I just need to take a probiotic and I'll be healthy. It's like, probably not, So can we just take a step back? Can you walk us through somebody who is appreciative of the word gut, but maybe has never thought of what actual digestion looks like, where it starts, how it happens? Let's give a basic rundown of there and we'll kind of go from there if you don't mind.
Yeah. And when we're really talking about the gut, at least for the most part, if we're using correct terminology, usually the gut, we're talking about the large intestine, small intestine. But if we're really, like you said, kind of talking about the whole system, we're talking about the gastrointestinal tract. So the GI tract, we're talking about everything from your mouth to your anus. So it encompasses much more. So you have your mouth, your esophagus, your stomach, your small intestine, large intestine, rectum, anus, the whole shebang. And so that really encompasses the entire GI tract. And the role of the GI tract is to really like help us intake, digest, and absorb food. So any like issues across the GI tract can have pretty big impacts because if you're not able to effectively digest and absorb things, you're going to have nutrient deficiencies, different things like that, that can present, with complications. And so when we're really talking about like the gut microbiome, and we get into that, what we're really talking about there is usually the large intestine and kind of the very end portion of the small intestine. So when you hear people talk about the gut microbiome, large intestine is synonymous for colon. And so we're really talking about that region of the GI tract. And then you do have some microbes that live in that end portion of your small intestine. From an anatomy perspective, the goal of the GI tract, so if we're walking through digestion and absorption, you put food into your mouth. Digestion even starts before you put food into your mouth. You're nodding. I know, like, dietitian stuff, we learn this again and again and again. You know, you're salivating, your saliva has digestive enzymes in it. You chew that food. That's a part of digestion. You swallow that. You have these peristalsis or rhythmic like movements that are moving food down into your stomach. Your stomach secretes some enzymes and then acid and things to start churning and breaking down that food and start to digest a little bit more. That goes into your small intestine. You have more enzymes come in just to break down more of those foods. You absorb a lot of food. So carbs, fats, and proteins, you absorb a bulk of that in that small intestine. Whatever is not absorbed in that small intestine is going to pass into the large intestine, where you're absorbing primarily water. So a lot of your water absorption comes from that, but then a lot of different vitamins and minerals get absorbed in the large intestine. That's really where your stool starts to become stool. You have anything that is passing into that is going to interact with your gut microbes. They're going to start to ferment and break down some of those foods. So thinking about fibers that we are not digesting as humans, but microbes have the ability to digest. They're going to produce different things for us. We're really going to form that solid stool, and then it's going to trigger that movement throughout our rectum and anus. So that's a overview of the GI process. Did I miss anything?
No, that is why I wanted to have you on the show, so we can get some level of thoroughness of, you know, each step along the way, because I want someone sitting here listening to that and appreciating the fact that there are so many inputs to this, and it's not just one system, one organ, one thing that's responsible for whether or not we bloat after a meal, for example, right? Like mastication and chewing and swallowing and how quickly things move and, you know, what gets absorbed where and what enzymes are responsible for what and what, hormones are also interplay here. And then not to mention the different organ systems. You know, we have our liver and our gallbladder and our pancreas and our kidneys. Like, we have all of these things that are also interconnecting with the gut. Yep. It's not just the tube that, you know, your sandwich, and then it comes out the other end, you know, eight hours later. There's a lot to do with a lot of different systems in there. So I appreciate you just laying that foundation, because I think that once we have this greater appreciation for there are a lot of systems at play, then we can actually be a little bit more nuanced, and we can start to identify where things might be going wrong, or where things might need some improvement, or how we can actually start to conceptualize what it means to take care of our gut at the end of the day.
And one organ that we didn't cover that, you know, doesn't get linked as an accessory organ for the GI tract often, but I would argue that it is the brain. So we sit here and think about, you know, stress, and a lot of people can relate to having GI issues when they're stressed or having some sort of complication when, you know, traumatic life events occur and stuff like that. So our brain is, you know, super important. And I'm sure we'll even touch on this even more, but our gut is really connected to pretty much every organ in our body for the most part in some way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'd love to touch base on the gut brain axis, which is, again, kind of another label that we're kind of throwing on things these days, serotonin production, all that good stuff. But kind of before we do some of that, you acknowledge the fact that there's a difference between the gut and the GI tract. Like, yes, one is within the other, but when we talk about the gut, we're kind of talking about the colon, the large intestine, specifically like the last half, last third. When it comes to gut health, okay, we're talking about the colon and the gut microbiota here. When we look at research, when we look at humans, you alluded to, I don't want this to be a leading question, but when we talk about things that we know, and again, I know we're going to talk about some things that we don't know yet, but when we look at humans, we look at animals, we look at just trends in research over time. What are things that we know can be of benefit and could be helpful when it comes to this blanket term of quote unquote gut health? Like, what comes to mind for you, or if someone's sitting here saying like, hey, I want to take care of my gut, what are some things that I should be doing? What is your first topic of discussion, or where do we go from there?
I work with a lot of individuals with GI concerns and gut concerns. Like, I always start with the basics, because if you do not have those covered, like doing all of these extra little things like supplements and all that kind of stuff is not gonna give you much benefit. So usually, and it sounds, you know, insane, but like some of the most simple things are the most impactful for an individual's gut health. But that's comes down to getting enough fiber, you know, making sure we're getting adequate fruits, veg, whole grains, legumes, you know, proteins, everything, getting enough food. I work with a lot of individuals with disordered eating habits of, you know, your gut's not going to feel good if you're not eating enough. Like you're going to be constipated. You know, you don't put food in your body, it's not going to move. So getting enough food and making sure there's adequate fiber in there as well. Hydration is super key. Your gut's going to be really off and not feel good if you're not getting enough, you know, water, but then electrolytes as well, which most people do an okay job with foods, getting their electrolytes. But then you have some of those, you know, high performing athletes that may need to look towards supplementation. Sleep, huge one. Sleep is a huge one for gut health. Our circadian rhythm helps, you know, control the movement of our gut and our GI health. So getting enough sleep and balancing that is really important too. Exercise, super important for the gut. I work with a lot of people that are high intense exercisers sometime, and we have to tailor things back a little bit because our gut really likes lower intensity exercise. It's not to say that high intensity exercise is bad, but you need to give yourself time to recover. And if you're having some serious GI issues and you are an ultra endurance runner, like we might have some things to address, you know, tailor things to make that easier for you. Trying to think, stress levels, big one. I work with so many clients that one of my first questions is, what are we doing about stress levels? Do we have someone we can talk to? Do we have methods to reduce stress? So really all of those are what I start with. And that tends to be the most impactful for most people.
I love that. And yeah, how dare you come on a podcast and talk about hydration and sleep and diversity, nutrient diversity and a fiber consumption in a world where it's like, hey, take this probiotic or butyrate supplement. And that's the thing that's likely going to populate or feed your good gut bacteria and yada, yada, yada. But again, we have to appreciate the fact that there are so many benefits and benefits that we cannot get from anywhere else outside of what the quote unquote big rocks are. And I find that the big rocks, that what it means to take care of your gut, it's the same when we're talking about metabolic health, right? Or we're talking about insulin sensitivity, or we're talking about managing your cholesterol. It's not all these things are unique to different systems within the body, but you bet your ass that the basics work on taking care of the gut in addition to your regular health and your physiological health and all these other inputs that go into it. But I just find it comical for me because I think we can get so into the weeds and so hyper-focused on these little individual components that sometimes people can forget the fact that, hey, if we have all of these, you know, fundamentals in place, things might improve on their own without being super hyper-individualized with some of these interventions and whatnot. So thank you for saying all that. Yeah. I think that those things go underappreciated. I know my audience appreciates that, but it's just not something that a lot of people, I think, feel excited about. And I want that to be a good thing. Like I want people to sit here and be like, oh, maybe it doesn't have to be as complicated. And there are situations where we have to be more nuanced to the person, of course. But those are the things that oftentimes I'd like to start with as well. So I'm happy you bring all those up.
The hard thing for people though, is it's, those are the simple things, but sometimes those are the hardest things to change for people. People just want a supplement. It, you know, taking it, remembering to take a supplement every day is easier than getting outside and, you know, going for a walk or hitting the gym or trying to get to bed at a reasonable time, you know, but it's really those behavior change and those foundational aspects that, you know, have the most benefit for overall health. It's not just gut health, it's your overall health.
Yeah. Much easier to just wake up, slam AG1, and then forget about all of your other food needs for the rest of the day. You know, I want to spend a little bit of time on fiber here for a second, because that's something that you appreciate and you've brought to the surface of like a order of importance. What are foods that have impacts on gut health directly? Fiber is one of them. Earlier when you were talking about the digestion process and how food goes from the mouth, you know, to the anus, like indigestible foods make it to the gut. Can we talk a little bit more about that? Fiber, for the people who don't know, is it something that's technically absorbed, or it makes it through the digestive tract like unabsorbed? And so why does that have unique benefits, or why is that something that is important when we're considering a healthy gut microbiota and a healthy gut in general?
Yeah. So there's a lot of facets to how fiber really does benefit our gut health and our overall health. One, we think of fiber, and there's different types of fiber. So historically, we classify them as soluble, insoluble. There's more ways to classify them, but soluble basically means it's going to dissolve in water. It's going to bind to water. Insoluble, think of more like roughage. It's not going to bind to water. It's going to act more like a broom in your GI tract. And so they both have their unique benefits, and then we can classify fibers into the kind of category of, are they fermentable? Are they non-fermentable? And that basically means, do they interact with the microbiome? Doesn't necessarily mean, are they prebiotic or not, but it really does mean, do they interact with the microbiome at all? But when we're talking about fiber, certain fibers will help. They help a lot with GI motility, so keeping things moving. So you have a benefit there because you don't want anything really sitting in your GI tract too long. You also don't want things moving through too quickly. If things are sitting in your GI tract too long, you're going to absorb more water. Things are going to get more hard. You're going to have a hard time passing that stool. It can lead to different complications. People that are dealing more with constipation are more at risk for diverticulosis/diverticulitis, which is development of those pouches in the large intestine that can get infected and be very serious. Constipation is also just uncomfortable for people, and you could get bowel obstruction if it's really serious, but we don't see that often. But then, if things are moving through too quickly, you're not absorbing enough water. So that's going to look like diarrhea on the toilet. And that can be indicative from a nutrition perspective of someone malabsorbing foods. So they're not going to be absorbing all the nutrients that they really need. And so motility is one way that fiber benefits us. It kind of, if we're having soluble fiber, that can help bind some of that water, slow things down a little bit. For dealing with, some constipation, maybe some insoluble fiber will help push things along and add some bulk and speed up transit time through the GI tract. Fiber also, like we said, when it passes through the GI tract undigested and enters the large intestine, where it's going to interact with microbes that have the ability to break these down, the real benefit of fiber from a outside of the gut perspective is they're going to be producing different things like short chain fatty acids. You've mentioned one already, butyrate. Butyrate is one of our most important short chain fatty acids. It helps maintain the integrity of our gut. So helps our cells in our gut be really healthy and tight so that we don't have what we call leaky gut, which is a whole nother buzz thing that we can get into later. But it helps ensure that our gut is really nice and tightly sealed. We have other short chain fatty acids that get produced too. And then there's other things that get produced from fiber that can get into circulation and can kind of help regulate things. Trying to think, I could talk about fiber all day. I don't know.
That was great. That was really great.
Yeah.
One thing I've talked about fiber a shit ton. I think
pun intended
for sure. But I think that a lot of people can sit here and nod their head along with like, yeah, fruits and vegetables, probably good, grains, legumes, yeah, like all of these fiber sources, those are probably health promoting and good for my guts. And the next question is like, how much is recommended? What is the RDA kind of your guidelines for most people and seeing how they respond to that and then going from there. But even with that, it's like, I find that doesn't always help people sometimes too, unless they're tracking food. Like no one knows what 35 grams of fiber fucking looks like at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I think having some of these recommendations could be helpful, but is there a way that you might help structure someone's day or educate on how much and what that looks like, or what types of foods can we get to get there? Like what is kind of a starting point if someone's sitting here and they're like, okay, cool, fiber is good, but how much? I don't even know where I'm at right now. Like, where do I even start with that?
Yeah. So one of the nice ways, working in the GI space and working with individuals that have some disordered eating habits, sometimes we don't track a lot. I have to get good at kind of guesstimating fiber and making sure we're in a good place. But one thing that one kind of proxy that I use for a lot of people is to in assessing like how's our fiber doing is your poop. So like how often are you going to the bathroom? What is the consistency? How does it feel when it passes? Because that's telling you a lot about, are we hitting that sweet spot? You know, are we going at least once a day, maybe once or twice a day? That's a really good sweet spot for people to be in. Some people will go less, some people will go more, but ideally we're getting to that at least once a day because that feels the best for people. And that's a good indicator that we're getting enough fiber to keep things moving along. If we're going 5-6 times a day and it's loose, like got some problems there. We could be overdoing fiber. We could not be having enough fiber to bind things up. And so then we assess what we're really doing. If we're going multiple days on end without eating fiber, like usually that's a good sign, or usually without going to the bathroom, not eating fiber. Usually that's a good sign that we're not eating enough fiber. And usually the way I kind of have conversations with people of how to incorporate fiber into their meals is we talk about foods that are sneaky high in fiber. So things like raspberries, avocados, those type of things that you don't always think of as being super high in fiber, but can be easy additions. But then just focusing each meal on having, like, for sure, I'm having one good fiber source. So it doesn't have to necessarily be a fruit or a vegetable. It could be an avocado. You know, it could be a fat source, but avocados are sneaky high in fiber. It could be, you know, some whole grains. It could be plant-based proteins. It could even be something that has fiber added. I don't hate processed foods. I think they have their time and place. Foods that have a little bit of fiber added can be helpful to help some individuals get some fiber in. In terms of how much people need, if you want hard numbers, I usually stick with around the RDA. What I like working with people more than the flat, like 25 grams for women, 38 grams for men, is the recommendation of 14 grams per 1,000 calories, because I find that it's more scalable, because you could have a woman that's a really high performing athlete and needs, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 3,500 calories a day. You know, 25 grams of fiber probably is not going to feel the best for them. Vice versa, if you're eating even lower, you know, hitting that might not feel good. But I work with a lot of individuals with IBS, and you have to have an open mind with fiber needs are really tailored. So I have some clients that can't tolerate more than, you know, 15 grams of fiber a day, and that's just where we're going to be at. But then I work with clients that have 50, 60, sometimes even 70 plus grams of fiber a day. So it's really kind of tailored. And I really think stool is a good proxy for that for most people.
Agreed. Yeah, I like that. I think when you sit back and think about, like, am I going to the bathroom once a day? Is it regular? Is it consistent? Am I straining? Those are usual things where even if you're not hitting the perfect amount of fiber every day, you can make adjustments to and see massive improvements on. Because like you said, you know, there's hard recommendations, and whether it's, you know, 35 to 38 or more if you're a male, or 25 if you're a female, or 15 grams of fiber for every 1,000 calories that you're eating. Like there's a handful of different recommendations out there, but just get a baseline assessment of where you're at, what you're doing, how much you're consuming, what you're feeling like, what your digestive symptoms are. And sometimes people can just do a little trial and error from there without hyper-focusing on numbers too. Yeah. I have the luxury of tracking food with people. I don't necessarily work predominantly with people who are recovering from eating disorders or who are currently diagnosed with one. Yeah, I usually refer on. So a lot of people, we have the luxury of being able to, like, oh yeah, you know what? You track your food for a week, you're getting 12 grams of fiber a day on average. It's like, that's really cool to see when you track for a period of time, and being able to talk about, you mentioned raspberries or all types of berries and different fruits and vegetables, things that you realize that, like, oh yeah, you know what? Like maybe a few additions instead of a massive overhaul is really what we're looking for here. So I think that's a really, really good starting point. You mentioned, I want to spend just a quick second here, but like the added fiber to products these days is everywhere. And I think like Quest protein bars was one of the first from my memory. Loading. I forget what types of fiber source they put in there. A lot of it is, especially with the bars out there, they just,
it's like a soluble corn fiber, I think, is the type that's in it. Yeah.
Totally. That inulin, psyllium husk might be used in some of these, but like some of these added fibers, you look at the Mission Wrap tortillas and you're sitting with somebody, it's like, okay, cool. I need more fiber. I'm just going to have two Mission tortillas every single day.
Yeah.
Is that good, bad, neutral? Is it something that you would add context to? I'm just curious if somebody's saying, oh yeah, I'll just have another Quest bar or the Kirkland protein bar. What would your response be to that? And is there any utility for that?
It is something that I would add context to. I don't think it's good. I don't think it's bad. I don't think having these things in a pinch could, you know, are a bad thing. Again, I work with a lot of individuals in the IBS space, and a lot of times we have to avoid these things because a lot of the fibers that are added to these products are highly fermentable, meaning that they're going to produce a lot of gas and bloat. So thinking about the fibers that are in your Olipop, the fibers that are in that inulin, chicory root, all of that kind of stuff can be pretty gas producing for a lot of people. I don't necessarily, you know, if you're trying to increase your fiber, I don't necessarily think they're a bad thing to include, but as a dietitian, we always get back to like whole foods are always a little bit better. Those fibers, when we're thinking about fibers that are added to foods, we term those more functional fibers. So those are fibers that are extracted and then added to foods versus fibers that exist in a whole food. They interact differently in our body. Oftentimes the ones that are in the whole food are more tolerated. And oftentimes they have other things with them that are going to just interact with our gut and be overall more beneficial versus having some of those extracted fibers that are added to more processed food. You know, they're not bad, but they can give people some GI concerns, and they're not where I would get the bulk of my fiber from. But, you know, some of those like low carb tortillas, if you're tracking and you're trying to cut, you know, calories, it can be helpful for some individuals, but also keeping in mind, like, if you notice, you know, the next day that you feel really bloated and your weight spiking, like, it might be you're bloated, you know?
Agreed. Time and place for everything. And I think some of those products can absolutely be helpful and maybe good substitutions for the alternative that other people might be having. And again, even just the somebody thinking about choosing a product that might be higher in fiber, I think could have a net positive effect depending on how they feel. And, you know, you can kind of do a little trial and error and experiment. It's like, I know for myself personally, like if I have a Quest bar, I'm farting for, you know, 24 hours, and I don't like to eat them. And it's something that if I have a mission wrap tortilla once a week or twice a week, it's like, I actually feel decent. It's not something that I have all the time. So everybody's going to have their own shared experience with that. And again, I love that you bring up back to the food and veg part and all these different types of fiber sources, because there's different classifications of fiber and no two foods are exactly identical when it comes to the benefits that you get from that, especially from a fiber standpoint. It's like you get your blueberries versus your Dave's Killer bread, whole grain bread versus oats versus your walnuts versus a banana versus the, you know, broccolis or whatever you're eating. It's like, I want people to appreciate all the different colors, all the different fiber sources. You have more diversity because you get different nutrients and different things from those foods that maybe you can't get just from one food alone. So I don't want people to sit here and think that they have to have something different every single day throughout the course of the month for them to be healthy. It's like maybe just doing a little audit of like, hey, here's the vegetables, the fruits, if any at all, that are in people's rotations. And how can we add or subtract to that? Or how can we choose some different colors? Or how can we choose a different recipe this week with asparagus instead of your favorite roasted broccoli that you have? Like, there are just, I think, ways that we can subtly improve. And that's what I feel like we're getting at here, is it doesn't have to be this intense overhaul of everything that you're doing. It's just the subtle addition of things and addition of things that you tolerate and you feel good with. And that trial and error over time can just do wonders for people, especially for their gut health.
And those small sustainable changes, like the small incremental baby step changes, are what's going to be most sustainable for people. Like it's not the massive overhauls. It's not, you know, working with clients. I rarely say like cut this out unless it's causing you like really bad GI, you know, issues. It's always, you know, working with a general population of just wants to eat healthier. Like, what can we add in versus what can we take away from? Because from a psychological perspective, you tell someone that they can't have this X, Y, and Z, they're only going to want that. And they're going to restrict it for a period of time, but that's going to be in their mind tempting, like, oh my gosh, I want this so bad. Eventually when they have it, they're going to overeat it. Like, that's just a psychological perspective. So I think in keeping that in mind is really important too, that those small changes, not major overhauls.
Yeah. And I love this conversation because just having a fiber goal, or, you know, if we look at the state of our population right now, I'd butcher the stats, but probably less than 10-15% of Americans eat actual 3-4 servings of fruits or vegetables per day. It's insane. So the bar is low for a lot of people here. And, you know, a lot of people listening to this podcast and consuming your content or my content are usually the people who give a shit a little bit more about some of these things. So maybe they're already doing some of these things well, but I just find that talking about fiber and having fiber recommendations it's such a wonderful goal for people to have, because there's so many other confounding variables and benefits you get from eating fiber-rich foods alone. We talk about micronutrients and all the different types of unique vitamins, minerals, different protein sources, things that we could get compounds from eating fiber alone. And so I find that it's such a wonderful recommendation because people who eat more fiber are probably going to feel better. You're going to feel more regular. Maybe you're going to have more energy. Maybe you're eating more whole foods. The addition of some of these nutrient-dense foods maybe takes away from the prepackaged, processed, you know, hyperpalatable things that people are consuming on a daily basis. So it's not the fiber alone, but the fiber has such a net positive on so many things when you find foods that agree with you that it's just, it's something that I've been super passionate about. When we track food with somebody, it's like total calories, protein, and fiber. I could give a fuck about fats and carbs these days, fiber is one of those that I think just does wonders for people if they're not already.
Yep, exactly.
Tell me about probiotics, prebiotics related to food here.
Yeah.
We talked about prebiotics, kind of alluded to fiber has these prebiotics, which essentially feed the good gut bacteria. So getting a diverse amount of fiber sources, getting enough fiber consistently, like that's very good. But as it comes to probiotics, especially, you know, things like, you know, different dairy products, kefir, yogurt, you know, sauerkraut, all these things that are kind of, I would say, like at the highlight of people's Instagram feed these days, do those have a place? Do those give the same benefits? And what would be recommendations based on some of those things?
Yeah. So actually just gave a talk about this, about, you know, probiotics from, you know, supplement form and probiotics from foods. When it comes to the probiotics from foods, so foods that are going to have those live bacteria within them or be fermented, those that have the most research are going to be your fermented dairies. So your kefir, your certain yogurts, even things like Yakult is a really popular one. It's like a Japanese little probiotic like drink. Has a good bit of research behind it. Some of your soy products too. So like some of your misos, some of your like tempeh. And then if you're really into Japanese culture, they're on top of it with probiotic and foods. There's something called natto, which is like, if you've ever looked it up, look it up if you haven't and you're listening to this, it's like fermented soybeans. They have a very unique texture. I went to Japan a few years ago and it was an experience, but that and then some of your fermented cabbages, like your kimchi and your sauerkrauts that are true sauerkrauts, not like what you would find in a can on the shelf. Those have the most research in terms of showing that they may have an overall benefit. The caveat there is there's not a great way to quantify the amount of probiotics you're actually getting in those because they're fermented products. They're not designed with, you know, the goal of those probiotics being in there necessarily. Those bacteria are in there to help create the food product that you're experiencing. And so there's really no way to be sure of how much you're actually getting. And the research is actually showing like maybe these probiotics don't actually even colonize the GI tract, but we know through that fermentation process, just like happens in our gut, they're producing different compounds, those bacteria are, and that can then have a health benefit, which is a new term called postbiotics. Which are the metabolites and things that those bacteria are producing are now being, you know, encapsulated in supplement form and sold. We don't have a lot of research on that area, so I wouldn't encourage you to go get a postbiotic supplement at this time. But they definitely have a place. My caveat with that is like they may not be health promoting in the way that probiotics historically have been marketed as like, oh, they're modifying the gut microbiome. You know, yeah.
Thank you for that clarification. I'm happy you bring up postbiotics as well, because I think that's been something that has been interesting for me to learn about firsthand as well. In addition to like, symbiotics and some of these, like you realize when you look at this food and you have this kimchi and it's like, okay, maybe, yeah, the fermented bacteria, all these things that could be in that product, maybe it doesn't even make it past the stomach. But that doesn't mean that there isn't additional health benefits or different things that your gut is feeding on that is also going to feed or, you know, produce or sustain and maintain the levels of healthy gut bacteria or populate, you know, insert literally anything else. But I think that appreciating the fact that, again, there's these different subsets of foods that could have benefits that could be incorporated for people to try or see if that's something that helps with their gut issues or their bloating or just making them feel good or hitting their protein goal for the day. Yeah. It's just, it's fun because when you look at food on these individual bases of like, yeah, some of these foods have different nice compounds that we can't get from somewhere else. So the incorporation of those just, it justifies making more of an effort for that over time. And I find when people can think about food sometimes in these ways, not to be so hyper-focused and so like, I got to eat this today and then this at this time and this, because this, these are all doing, it's like, no, like the point we're getting at here is there's so many unique benefits that a lot of different foods and food varieties could give us that I don't want people to sit here and eat the same breakfast, same lunch, same thing every single day and expect that they're getting all the benefits of eating a healthy diet when there's other areas that we could potentially, you know, lean on to get some unique health benefits you can't get from elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
We're kind of bouncing around here a little bit, but we've talked about fermented foods, fermented fibers, fermentable type of carbohydrates kind of a lot here. What, you know, when we talk about FODMAPs, it's kind of where I'm going here is like there's low FODMAPs, high FODMAPs. What are FODMAPs? What are, if someone's in here thinking like, yeah, you know, I have some digestive issues, I have IBS, and somebody have said maybe going low FODMAP could help. Like we're talking about all the benefits of fiber, but we know we have people sitting here listening like, yeah, I don't feel good when I eat fiber sometimes. I don't feel good. Like how do we start to differentiate some of these different fiber type of products? And how can we kind of simplify that to explain it? Like, yeah, maybe there's better or worse things that you could have for you individually. And how can we go about kind of figuring what that is?
Yeah. So FODMAP is actually an acronym, and I'm not going to read it all out because it basically breaks down to fermentable small carbohydrates for the most part. And so the fermentable is the important aspect there. They're basically things that we eat, which end up being a lot of fibers that reach the large intestine or can reach the large intestine, undigested, unabsorbed. Your bacteria love them. And then they will metabolize that and produce a lot of gas, pull water into the intestine. It causes just that sloshy feeling for people. So you can end up with diarrhea. Some people end up with constipation from FODMAPs. A lot of times we see more so diarrhea and gas though. So FODMAPs, you know, not everyone needs to eliminate them. Most people can tolerate, you know, them pretty well. The low FODMAP diet. So if you've been told by a provider or GI doc to here's a low FODMAP diet, you should follow this, find another provider, because a low FODMAP diet is one, not something that meant to be long-term. It is a very structured and phased elimination diet where you remove all the FODMAPs and then you slowly add one back in at a time and test your tolerance to then say, okay, all of these foods I'm fine with, but there's this one food or group of foods that I'm not. And then you tailor that even further and say, okay, how much can I really tolerate of this? Maybe I can tolerate a half cup of this, or maybe I can tolerate a couple tablespoons of this, but I reach this threshold and that's too much. And so that really should be done with a trained dietitian in that area to kind of help you do that process, because a low FODMAP diet is never meant to be long-term. Meant to be a phase elimination diet where you add things back in and then your life resumes and you can eat what you want with, you know, the caveat of maybe we identified some foods that you're a little bit more sensitive to. And most people don't have that many issues with it. I personally, even working with individuals that have IBS, which are the main target for this low FODMAP diet, I don't approach it with the low FODMAP 100%. We're doing this, you know, 12 plus week elimination diet sometimes. I know the high FODMAP foods that give people a lot of issues. So we're thinking some of the things that give people the most issues, onions, garlic, and asparagus are some of those common ones, mainly onions and garlic. Apples kind of fall in there sometimes too, but really onions and garlic, because they're sneaky, they're in everything. You know, I've tried to like flip over like, you know, pre-cooked chicken in the freezer and it's always seasoned with onions and garlic. Like it's always like everything has onion and garlic in it. And so that ends up being something that's difficult for people to implement, but ends up being some of your high FODMAP foods that you can cherry pick. I use that, you know, kind of cherry picking approach to help people see like, well, let's try this versus the full elimination diet first. And so not everyone needs to eliminate FODMAPs, but if you notice that you're having, if you have IBS or if you're having really consistent bloating, it can be helpful to look for a practitioner that might specialize in it, or even just familiarize yourself with foods that are high FODMAP and low FODMAP. If you Google low FODMAP foods, high FODMAP foods, there's charts that come up. And you could even just as a individual, you don't have to be trained to do this, look through and be like, oh, I'm eating a lot of high FODMAP foods and I'm feeling really gassy and bloated afterwards. You know, that's a decent feedback that you can take into practice and maybe not have to go through a full elimination diet.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you bring up a really good point here where if you're somebody or somebody's listening to this podcast and it's like, you're the 5% of the population that really struggle. 5% is an arbitrary number. I just made that up, but just like, you're really struggling. You're confused. You're eating fiber. You say you're eating clean. Like, you have all of these like thing check marks that you're crossing off. Like, I shouldn't feel symptomatic, but I do. Those are people where it is worth going and working with someone like Jesse or, you know, other really smart. And I'm not going to maybe put myself, I'm not a gut health dietitian necessarily, but we absolutely work on that a lot with my clients too. But it is worth the 2 to 6 month kind of commitment of figuring that shit out with somebody who knows what they're doing, who isn't going to sell you just like an IgG test and say, cut out all these foods at the, you know, for the week and see how you feel. It's just, I do think that, again, we're biased and we're in the space, but that's something that I just want more people to appreciate and ask for help on, instead of going to Instagram and, you know, doing this like trial and error type of thing on their own for 5 years and realize that they're still stuck in day one, or sometimes they're worse after that because they didn't actually work with kind of an evidence-based provider. And it's just a dangerous, kind of tricky kind of social environment right now for this kind of stuff.
We're not appealing though, because we're not flashy and we're not promising that we're going to cure you overnight. So that's hard. It's easy for people to prescribe, like you said, in a food sensitivity test and say like, well, if I just take this test, it'll tell me exactly what foods I should cut out. And like, it's not evidence-based. I mean, it sounds great in theory. If that was the case, we'd all be doing it. Trust me, you know?
Yeah. You know, it is something that sells is the, you know, the extremes, the Whole30s, and not to shit on Whole30, carnivore diet is all the rage right now. That is a huge extreme to this, but all of these things are just different forms of elimination diets.
Yeah.
Again, we can't shit on people's experience where it's like, you have somebody, it's like, oh yeah, I cut out all plant foods, or I just started eating ribeyes and eggs and, you know, unpasteurized milk. And I started drizzling honey on my berries when I started eating them in the morning. I felt like $1 million. It's like, yeah, like there's maybe a reason why that might work for you very acutely, like in the short term, but it's probably not for the reasons you likely think or are being advertised to that. And again, all of these different types of elimination diets, again, like you alluded to, should not be done forever, because there's missed opportunities on a lot of different things that you could be eating or should be eating that you react completely fine to, that you're missing out on those benefits from. And by exiling everything and just trying to eat all animal based or all, low FODMAP based for the rest of your life, it's just, sometimes that could be working against you again, if you're not doing it in the right headspace.
Exactly. Yeah. These elimination, like on both ends of the spectrum, whether you're, you know, in the plant sphere or whether in the like carnivore sphere, and like acutely, we see people will tout benefits, but it's like, come back to me in a few years and say like, one, mentally, are you feeling like this is supportive and sustainable? Because there's not that many restaurants where you can go out and get, you know, exclusively plant-based or exclusively carnivore and it'd be good and enjoyable. And it's like, is that sustainable? And two, what are your blood markers look like in a couple of years? Like, they might look good now. Maybe you cut out calories and maybe you're losing some weight, maybe things are improving, but I don't want to like be like poop on people's parties, but the research supports that, long term, that might not be the case.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Which brings me up to this next thing of like different claims, different sales pitches, different types of, again, just buzzwords and marketing campaigns and things out there that people are buying into that, again, maybe aren't evidence-based or maybe aren't there yet, or maybe being being completely misrepresented. And there's a lot of actual lies being portrayed with some of the sales pitches correlated with some of these things. I'm thinking about different types of gut testing, different blood testing. We mentioned IgG testing previously. If you could just list of a handful of things that you see that are being sold a lot to people right now, and again, to a very vulnerable population that is willing to spend an arm and a leg on anything that they think might actually give them some benefit. What are things that you would list as maybe a red flag? And maybe it's not, and you can classify as maybe some utility, don't know yet, some neutrality, if anything, maybe some actual negative. Like, what are some classifications and things that come to mind for you when you're thinking about gut health in this space right now?
Yeah, I think that IgG test, really falls into the negative category in terms of people are going to, if you're unfamiliar, the way this works is you go and get a blood test done, this food sensitivity test. It's going to come back and tell you all the foods that you're quote unquote sensitive to. But this test is actually based off of an antibody that is functions as a memory antibody in your body. And so essentially what it's telling you is like, we've been exposed to this food before, and it's probably going to come up higher to the foods you eat more frequently and more recently. And so it can feel really gratifying for a lot of people because they'll see that and they'll be like, oh, I feel like crap and I'm eating this every day. It's like, I mean, it sounds good in theory, but the science really isn't there. And so it can lead to people cutting out a lot of things and reducing the diversity of their diet, which, you know, in the space that I work in, you know, IBS and some disordered eating habits, that can worsen things rather than make things better. So that one definitely falls into kind of the negative category. Hair mineral analysis is another one that we see, and like not worth it. Research isn't there. It's kind of a waste of money. The one that, you know, I'm willing to keep an open mind about right now is that GI map testing. Currently, the research is not fully there for its full utility. So essentially, it's a stool test that will test different levels of bacteria and certain proteins and different things in your gut that you can then maybe work to optimize. The problem is we really don't have defined clinical parameters for what those levels really need to be of specific bacteria outside of, you know, a pathogenic infection. So like you're having a serious actual infection, in which case you're probably seriously symptomatic and you probably will have already gone to the doctor about it. And so GI map for me is one that I'm willing to keep an open mind on for its utility in the future if more research emerges. I know some dietitians that use it and they are responsible with it. I just personally don't love it in terms of I'm not comfortable with the application of what we get. So it says this is out of range. Like we really don't have defined clinical, you know, evidence to like, this is what you need to change then if this is out of range. And so that's where I struggle a lot with that one. Trying to think of others. Those are the big ones that I encounter. Are you remember thinking of any others?
Those are huge ones. Yeah. I mean, there's so many different variations of the stool test out there now in America and all these other brands that kind of, again, just kind of have a different product. The thing that I found, because we don't have a ton of time. I'm not going to give a ton of story backstory here, but I'm somebody who is a dietitian, got into the functional space and now came out of it after ordering GI maps, ordering HTMA tests, ordering Dutch tests. And like you said, it's not that there's no utility for things like the GI map or some of these other hormonal testings and maybe certain blood marker stuff. But I find personally, whether or not we have a GI map results in front of us, and maybe there's certain, like you test, and I was like, oh yeah, you just came back from Mexico and you have candida or some shit. It's like, you know, maybe there's things that we could suspect that might be fucking things up at the end of the day. But a lot of the things that we're going to recommend are things that, again, are going to be evidence-based, things that we need to come back to, all the basics. And those are usually the things that, quote unquote, make significant improvements for some of these people, independent of what a GI map might say. And the thing with the GI map that I found interesting too, it's like you're measuring these levels, detectable levels of these different DNA parts of the bacteria, whatever, in the stool. Like we can't even measure it within the gut. So there's a lot of different, you know, variability in what we might actually see on a GI map versus what we actually do in a lab or what we could actually physically test what's going on in your gut right now. So I just find that me going through that process and people swear by them. And yeah, of course, like you have people and you make some of these changes, you could do that independent of the GI map sometimes too. But again, I find that these things that I've always alluded to the fact that we are 5, 10 plus years away from knowing a lot more about what the gut is going on right now. And again, that's just the thing that from a consumer standpoint, like you're not going to be excited about people like us maybe expressing kind of skepticism or talking about the flaws of some of these things and talking about things in an uncertain way. We can certainly talk about things in an uncertain way. And we talk about the things we know now versus somebody sitting here that is saying, I can have this fixed for you for a $600 GI map and a $1,000 consultation and X, Y, and Z. And that's the shit that we're seeing more and more these days. And that's the shit that I really get worked up over and something that kind of pisses me off because people who aren't credentialed are doing this. And a lot of times, again, they could be doing more harm than good, especially people running IgG tests and all of these things you alluded to. So it's just, Yeah, it's just alarming because that stuff is being rampant these days, and it's something I don't think is going to slow down, unfortunately.
No, I don't think so either.
No. Yeah, I think, yeah, at the end of the day, like if I could summarize this in one word, it's like we're talking about the gut, we're talking about all of these really important things, but I still don't want to stand here and say we have to micromanage every different organ system within our body. We see it all the time with like people trying to micromanage their blood sugar response after meals, right? Or trying to quote unquote, minimize their cortisol spike in the afternoon, or trying
Meanwhile, they're
to
stressing about all of this, which impacts your blood sugar and your cortisol.
exactly. It's the stress of doing these things that is doing more harm than actual benefit in certain situations. So I
Yeah.
just find that the gut is no different. And unfortunately, and fortunately for a lot of people listening, it comes down to the basics and it comes down to a lot of these things. And we could be a little bit more minimal with this, which I think is very good for a lot of people to hear because it doesn't have to be over the moon complicated with a lot of this stuff. Chances are you could find a lot of progress with a lot of these things that we talked about today and just a little bit of experimentation with a provider or you doing things smartly with yourself that, again, could get you to a place where you're saving thousands of dollars on a lot of these tests that again aren't really leading you to the destination that you hope it's going to be sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. So beautifully said.
Thank you so much. We gotta bookmark a part two in the future at some point, but
For
this
sure.
is really fun. There's a lot of things that we could have gotten into, but I'm really happy we stuck with the basics today and talked about a lot of the things that I've been thinking about. Tell the people where they can find you, how they can communicate with you and all
Yeah.
that stuff.
So I am on Instagram at Jesse Hoffman underscore PhD. That's where I'm most active. I have a TikTok, but I don't really use it. So I just use it to doom scroll TikTok. I also have a website. It's www.jessephd.com. If you are interested and if you have IBS or interested in working with me, you can inquire there. I have some options for people to find me, connect with me, and work with me. Also love to doing podcasts if you're listening and you want more podcasts or speaking events, I do that too. So you can find all that information on my website. But Instagram is my main gig.
Thank you,
So
Jesse.
that's
I'll
me.
plug all that in the
Yeah.
show notes. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks so much. It was great.
Thank you again for listening to this episode. If you found value and enjoyed it, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media. If you do, make sure you tag me so I can say thanks. Or if you're on iTunes, scrolling down and leaving a 5-star review would be much appreciated. And if you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always find me on Instagram at LukeSmithRD. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your day. I'll see you on the next episode.